Welcome to the Oldie Literary Lunch, sponsored by Noble Caledonia, the world experts in small ship cruising.
Our next speaker, and you'll get the relevance. If I say the name Kelly and Singing in the Rain, you obviously think of Jean, but think again. Here is Rachel Kelly with her subject, Exercises, a comprehensive workbook that comprises endless ways to get the most out of your life. But despite all my good resolutions, my only exercise has been jumping to conclusions. Enough, before my aged knees turn to jelly. Welcome our author, Rachel Kelly.
Thank you very much, Barry. And in a way, I feel a bit of an imposter because I don't really have any good parrot jokes. And I don't have this incredible connection with history and Christopher's knowledge of Peter Carrington. And even a few years ago, actually, if you'd asked me, would I stand and address an audience like this, I would have been quite surprised. So really, why am I here? What I'd just ask you to do, and bear with me, because I hope it will become obvious why I think I'm here. Maybe could close your eyes, you don't have to, but just pause and reflect and have a think about your own lives and indeed your family's lives, and just ask yourself whether you've ever experienced any kind of mental illness, if you've been touched by depression or anxiety or anything else, bulimia, post-traumatic stress. Just take a moment and think if that's true for your families. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened to me in that way. I've had an experience of severe depression. And then now for my next thought is just ask yourself, and again, keep this to yourselves, just really honestly consider whether you've been very open about that experience, especially in your place of work, if you're working, and being able to sort of talk about it and talk about this whole topic, which has very much come to the fore in the last few years. But the reason I mention that is I suppose that explains why I am here, because what happened was about 5 years ago, I decided to write a memoir about my own experience of suffering, as I say, from severe depression. So what I'd like us to do is just, can we just rewind? We can go back to 1997. So maybe some of you weren't alive in 1997. But anyway, we got the Blair landslide, if you remember, the Blair landslide election. And indeed, my husband, who's here, Sebastian, was standing as a Tory candidate in North Manchester. And I was working at the Times newspaper. And it was a great job. I absolutely loved it, but it was a stressful job. So probably, in some ways, some of the stresses of modern life were already very evident back in 97. We were already on a sort of 24-hour news cycle. We were constantly available. I could be called by the news editor at The Guardian and said, look, they've got a story on your topic, follow up. So it was a demanding job. But I thought I was managing fine. And the final bit of the picture was that we had two small children. And then what happened was one night, and it was in May 1997, I couldn't get to sleep. So I later discovered that insomnia is very characteristic of people who suffer from anxiety and depression. I didn't know that at the time. I'd had bits of insomnia before, but actually this insomnia was rather different. I was lying there in bed, and I couldn't get to sleep, and I began to feel my heart beating really hard. And I don't know any of you have that sensation of a shoe, that thing when a shoe is in the washing machine and it's going boom, boom, boom. You can hear it kind of banging. And it felt a bit like that, like my heart might sort of burst out of my rib cage. And I began to feel very sick, like I should throw up. And I didn't actually throw up. And my mind was absolutely racing. Again, I later discovered that this kind of thinking that I was involved in is called catastrophic thinking. And my thoughts went something like this. They went, well, you know, if I don't get to sleep, I can't get to work. And if I can't get to work, then I'm going to lose my job. And if I lose my job, I'm going to lose the house. I'm going to lose the children. Zero. Hero to zero, you might say. All over. It's interesting, actually, how remarkably quickly our minds, even a matter of minutes, can change from everything being fine to actually everything's not fine at all. Anyway, the night wore on, and I felt iller and iller. I also developed a very frightening sensation that I had to hold on to things. I started sort of gripping the bed. Anyway, I supposedly was this high-functioning person, middle-functioning, actually, more like it. But anyway, I thought, okay, refast an activity to its normal timetable. I'll breakfast at breakfast time. I'll lunch at lunchtime. I'll dine at dinner time. And I'll get back to sleep at night time, and I'll be busy and back to my normal, you know, keep calm and carry on kind of multi-juggling kind of life. But unfortunately, I didn't. I stayed up the next night. I felt iller and iller. Happened for 3 days and three nights before I found myself in hospital. And when I got to hospital, I assumed I was about to see a cardiologist because I thought, actually, I was having a heart attack. And the doctor sat me down. He said, no, he said, I'm not a cardiologist. He said, I'm a psychiatrist. And I said, well, you've made a frightful mistake. That's not me at all. Not me at all. And he said, well, yes, he said, these are very classic signs of a major depressive episode, born of anxiety, born of overwhelm, born of overtrading, all the symptoms, the fear, flight, or fright response you'll have heard of. So you empty your stomach so you can run faster, your heart beats faster so you can escape from the lion on the savannah. Your mind is racing because you're trying to grip this dread, this fear, this terrifying feeling you've got, and that's what's going on. And so it proved. I went into hospital. I suffered a major depressive episode. I was treated with drugs and therapy. No therapy at that stage. Drugs, medication. So the kind of antidepressants that calm you down, sleeping pills. 6 months later, I got back to work. Now, I don't know how you all fared on the exercise in the start of my talk, but at that time, in 97, I wasn't going to talk about this idea that I was someone who suffered from a mental illness and I'd suffered from depression. Shut the topic down, and I thought the whole thing would go away. And if it had, I wouldn't be here today. But what happened was my luck held for a few years, and then a few years later, I had a second major depressive episode. Quite similar circumstances, taking on too much, sort of anxious driving, this stress response becoming chronic. And that time, I was ill for roughly 2 years. And I know it was around 2 years, because during that period, I didn't pick up one of our sons from school. He was given a prize for bravery. So I suppose my message here is is there any way that I could have avoided this and not gone the sort of long way round and been so ill and found good strategies to look after myself? So that second major episode sort of ended around 10 years ago, and since then I have been investigating really with my old sort of journalistic hat. What are good strategies? How can we stay calm and well? How can we look after ourselves? Where can we find good ways to look after our mental health? And I think there are three things I'd like to say that I've learned in this process. And I stand here as someone who is calm and who is well and who hasn't had a third episode. And I think the three principles, in a way, that I learned start with really this principle of the sort of indissolubility of mental and physical. And I think it's still true today, and certainly in my experience of working with doctors, is that we do split mental and physical. So you'll have heard of René Descartes, the 17th century French scientist, and the Cartesian model, which splits mind and body. And this is absolutely how we still treat mental illness. We have physical illness, we have mental illness. And in fact, I think this will be a revolution that started. It's putting the two together, and I think through that revolution, we will do a lot to defeat stigma, because we will understand much more about this kind of indissolubility of the two. So as part of that journey, I wrote a lot about nutrition. I wrote a cookbook called The Happy Kitchen about good mood food and how our physical health affects our mental health. My second principle, which is actually the subject of my most recent book, so my first workbook for people who suffer from anxiety and depression, is kind of in a way the difference between thinking and doing. So our basic therapeutic approach to mental problems in the NHS is cognitive behavioural therapy. And that basically means a way of rethinking and using thinking in a different way to sort of enhance our mental health. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. But increasingly what I've found in this sort of 10-year period, and through this period I've worked with lots of different mental health charities. I'm an ambassador for SANE and Rethink Mental Illness. So in the workshops that I run, I can almost immediately spot people who are going to recover. And it's something to do with agency and empowerment and believing that you can make a difference. I think there's a problem in mental health. We often think that people, once they're given a diagnosis, that's it. They're going to be depressed forever and there's nothing they can do. And this kind of passivity and a kind of hopelessness, Martin Seligman, a psychologist, called it a learned helplessness, is actually not true. People can recover, and I'm living proof of that, which is why I decided to write a workbook. It's very interactive. There are all sorts of things that you can actually do. And I think that strategy, this sense of empowerment, is sort of lost in some of the strategies that we now embrace for good mental health. So number one, mental and physical. Number two, empowerment. And I can't think what number three was. But, you know, I often find with speeches people go on a bit long. So I'm sure you won't mind. I may remember number two and come back to you. But those two are very important to me. And that was really why I wrote this notebook, this workbook, Singing in the Rain. So listen, if it helps you or helps anybody in your family, obviously prevention is better than cure. That was number three. Yeah, I remembered. Phew. Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, so the gist of it is, if I could talk to my younger self, if I could have gone back to 1997 when I was in my early 30s, what I would have liked to have known is actually prevention is better than cure. And there's just so many good things that we can do, and that actually we should learn and should give mental health the sort of same priority we give physical health, and that actually this is an incredibly positive thing. We've got 7 million people on antidepressants. They don't all need to be on antidepressants. So that's my third message. It's a message of hope, but thank you all very much.
For more about the Oldie magazine, Amber Lunches, go to theoldie.co.uk.